Tickets are on sale now for Spotlight On's next live event, an all-ages show at the Royal Room in Seattle, Washington, on June 22, 2024. Spotlight On: Improvisation in Music and Life will be a unique program of performance and conversation between me and the James Falzone Division Ensemble. Together, we'll explore the nature of improvisation in music and how its principles can be useful in all aspects of life, for musicians and non-musicians alike. Different types of composing in the moment will be demonstrated, interspersed with interludes of discussion, covering what each musician brings to and gets from the experience. Audience members will become participants through a Q&A session that will afford a rare opportunity to gain deeper insight into the art and science of improvisation. Falzone's Division Ensemble is a group of master improvisers that includes James Falzone on clarinet, Ray Larson on trumpet, Wayne Horvitz on piano, Abby Blackwood on bass, and Rocky Martin on drums. For tickets and other information, visit spotlightonpodcast.com or theroyalroomseattle.com. For those of you who cannot join us in person, we would still welcome and appreciate your support in the form of a ticket purchase. If you can, please do, as it would mean the world to us and to this important independent venue. Thanks. Hello and welcome to Spotlight On, a production of 23 Media Ventures. I'm your host, Lawrence Purrier. Today the spotlight shines on saxophonist-composer Kevin Sun. Kevin joined us to discuss, amongst many other things, his dramatic double album from 2023, The Depths of Memory. The album was released in two halves, From All This Stillness in July of that year, and The Depths in Slow Motion that October. Kevin's an intense yet accessible player and composer, and a true working musician. You'll find him leading his ensembles most Tuesday nights at Lowlands Bar, and he appears regularly at Bar Bayou and Ornithology, all three in Brooklyn, New York. In the time since we recorded this talk back in January, Kevin has released a new record, a live one, recorded at Lowlands. Fate of the Tenor has him leading a trio which, to my ears, gives more than a passing nod to Joe Henderson's great 1985 live trio recordings with Ron Carter and Al Foster, State of the Tenor. Even the cover art seems a bit of an homage. The saxophone trio is one of my favorite configurations, and Kevin's new record is a terrific contribution to the canon. Links to Kevin's music are in the show notes, longer versions of which appear in the episode's entry on spotlightonpodcast.com. Thank you for making time today.
Absolutely. Yeah, excited to be here.
I wanted to understand a little bit about sort of your musical biography.
Sure.
Starting even where are you from and your musical upbringing, your early musical exposure and interest. I'd love to learn that about you.
Sure. So I grew up in central New Jersey in a small township called Montgomery. It's right next to Princeton. Pretty rural, suburban, very quiet. I started playing music, taking piano lessons when I was 8 years old. My parents made me do it, you know, sort of a classic thing.
Same, yeah.
For many Asian Americans also. And so did that in fourth grade. I started playing saxophone as part of the band program. So I was 10. And then I got into playing jazz when I was around 13, 12 or 13. A friend of mine gave me a CD that was for like an extracurricular, like an enrichment music appreciation class. It was like a burned CD of a bunch of jazz recordings. And I was just curious. I had never listened to jazz. And I heard The Girl from Ipanema and the saxophone solo. Sangat's saxophone solo just transformed me in some deep way. I actually didn't realize it was a saxophone. I heard it and it was a beautiful sound. I couldn't tell what it was, really, because my idea of saxophone was fourth grade band saxophone, you know, or sixth grade band at that time. And so I became obsessed and I switched to the tenor saxophone and it all grew out from there. And I kept playing, started to take jazz lessons in terms of improvising. There's a great local teacher, Laurie Altman, who used to live in Princeton and he taught at the, what was it called? Westminster Choir College. That's still there. Mm. He taught composition, but he played jazz like in the 80s and 90s. He lived in New York City and he was playing on the scene and he's on some records. But then he moved to the suburbs, and he also had this separate life of being like a serious Western classical composer. So that's why he was teaching that. And he moved away from jazz, but he was a great player. And so he taught me a lot. We basically just played. He introduced me to a lot of music, played tunes. He gave me a lot of conceptual ideas about improvising and thinking about just playing music. And then I went to music school. Actually, I did my undergraduate at Harvard. I studied English. I was taking music courses at the same time with the New England Conservatory, and I did a master's degree there. And I moved to New York in 2015.
Does your undergrad experience, does that reflect some notion that you had an idea that maybe music wasn't going to be a professional pursuit for you?
Definitely. Yeah. I have to say, late high school, I just wasn't sure. And I felt like, you know, I definitely love music and I still do. But I think at that time, I wanted to keep my options open. It's a funny thing because that sort of perspective has been my whole life. It's still true today. But I was just curious what else the world had to offer. And I think just the opportunity to study at a world-class university, be exposed to a lot of different ideas that weren't just musical, it just appealed to me. And so that is sort of why I went that path rather than going straight to music school or trying to play music professionally.
I appreciate that this may be a little bit of a sort of cliched or hack question, but did your undergraduate studies, does it bring anything to you, to your musical life? Is there any sort of influence or perspective that studying the humanities that way, studying English in particular, does it make its way into your composition or your improvisation?
It does. I think it manifests in a lot of different ways. I think maybe the most obvious is song titles. You know, I like to have wordplay in my song titles. And I think this is just very personal to me, but I feel like sometimes there can be a lot of, for lack of a better word, lazy titling that happens after the fact in terms of certain song titles that seem to just pop up again and again, even though the music may be great, but I think the person who wrote the song, that was sort of an afterthought. And so for me, I kind of love sometimes just starting with the song title, like having an idea, having some phrase that seems really fertile or something that gets my imagination going. And there's certain composers who I like Henry Threadgill Gill, who are amazing composers and artists, but also amazing titles. And I think they can go hand in hand.
That's interesting to me that you go right to the song titles, because listeners to this podcast will recognize that I bring that topic up a lot with instrumental artists, because I'm very curious about the role of song titles and the different perspectives that artists have. Some say what you just said, which is they start with a song title or a theme, and others, it's much more slapdash, to the extent of even like letting somebody else name the songs or not really knowing what the song should be titled until after they play back and hear it right a few times. I wonder if, as an extension of that, is there a narrative element? Is narrative part of your improvisational construct?
It's an interesting thing in improvisation because it's all sort of emergent. Like you can't plan it out ahead of time. You can have a sense of how it might go based on having played a certain song a bunch of times with the same people. I think generally when I'm thinking about narrative as a composer and as an improviser, I just try to see it in the broader context of the song. As a composer, I'm thinking about what episodes, what sequence events are going to happen. And it really varies, depends on the context of the band. Like if it's a smaller group versus a larger group, how much pre-composition or sort of like notated stuff you need ahead of time, or at least just fixed material, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see extremes all the time, and it's, a lot of it can be a matter of taste. Like some people just, they like to hear, or they want to go in with no preconceptions or predetermined materials and just let the narrative be totally emergent 100%, which can be cool. And it can also be totally boring. It just depends on what happens with that group of musicians on that night in that room with that audience. I think of myself as being, I want maximum expressive possibility within a framework. And I also want the framework to be maximally interesting in terms of, I wanted to have something formal that the musicians are really digging into. Like I wanted to have as much complexity as I can bring in sophistication as a musical thinker and composer without totally putting the musicians into handcuffs. So that's the sort of like tightrope that I'm trying to walk.
Yeah.
That's how I see myself, at least.
Could you dive into that a little bit more or make that a little more tangible for me? Like, how does that manifest? Is that direction? Is that prompt? What's the direction the musicians are getting?
For me, for instance, a lot of my songs, especially in the past, I'd say 5 years, there's a pretty heavily rhythmic component or to go a step more specific, it's metrical, it's meter, it's actually how long conceptually certain things are happening, like bars of music. A lot of times we keep a consistent meter because that helps to make it more, it's more conducive to grooving, which is huge for jazz, which is fundamentally dance music. But what I'm interested in and what I have been interested in is writing music that essentially uses mixed meter a lot. So it changes meter constantly, but I want the effect to be for the listener that it's this sort of interesting flow of musical events happening in an asymmetrical kind of way, which I think is closer to our experience of reality anyway. It's not all totally regular. And the challenge there is to try to make it groove. So you want, as a musician, as an actual like person executing the material, you want to hide the seams of where the bar lines are. You know, you want it all flow, and it should be obvious to the listener that all the musicians are moving together through time and through the music. But what exactly they are referring to might not be obvious because we're hiding it as we're improvising. I think the best drummers and bass players, they find a balance of delineating parts of the structure and the form, but also elaborating on it, embellishing in a way that, you know, adorning it, if that makes sense. That's sort of what I'm going for.
You made the comment about jazz being essentially dance music, and it's another topic I love to discuss with instrumental musicians or jazz musicians, this notion that if you have an awareness of the history and where it came from and how it went from the dance hall to the club to the conservatory to sort of becoming something that people sat down and watched and analyzed as opposed to a seatless room with people dancing, and the role that sort of World War II played in the demise of the big band, just that the transitions of jazz over the last, really its whole life, the last 100 years or so, is fascinating. And I'm more familiar with your music than I am your writing, but I'm very interested in the fact that there's that important element to you of analysis, commentary, connecting with the history and the lineage. I wonder, rather than me declaring the role that that plays for you, if you could talk a little bit about the why of the writing in your life.
I used to be more involved in terms of writing about music. And I think in the past 5 years or so, I've pulled back from it because it's very easy to get pigeonholed. I feel like in New York, like I had the sense maybe 5 years ago that people thought of me more as like a music writer, blogger than a saxophone player and composer. There's sort of a conscious decision on my part to not be so public about it. I still think about music and I have a notebook and I write down thoughts and things, but I'm not advertising that, so to speak, as much. I started a blog in 2012. So I was partway through college, and I was basically inspired by like Ethan Iverson's blog, Do the Math, which was basically his musical diary of whatever, of what he was checking out, what he was curious about. It eventually became more formal in the sense that he'd really be doing heavy duty interviews with serious artists that were heavily prepared ahead of time in terms of listening through an artist's discography and having a very specific questions. That just appealed to me. I was already studying music and trying to learn as much as possible. I was curious about history, and I just figured, why not just share whatever I was discovering or thinking that I was discovering? Because I thought if it's helpful to me, it might be helpful to someone else. And also other people can share their perspective. I might be wrong about how I'm interpreting something, or or maybe I'm missing some facts. So I wanted to just put it out there. And at that time in the early 2010s, my sense was already the sort of earlier era of the internet with blogs and a lot of commentary was on the way down. But there's still enough that I did get a lot of useful feedback from people on Twitter, older musicians and things like that. And so I just kept it going essentially until I moved to New York, and then I got pretty busy with other things. So I pulled back on it.
The Ethan Iverson analogy is interesting to me. I love hearing the voice of an artist through that medium, when the analysis and commentary and the contextualization in the tradition, it's such a unique vantage point that I think only adds to the listening experience. It's another way to approach the artist.
Yeah, it's one of the best genres. I mean, I think like art writing from artists as a genre in itself, musician to musician interviews, that's where you get the deep lore and sort of the juiciest material, because those are the people who live through it and have this really deep, immediate connection to it. Which is not to say that critics or people who are not necessarily practitioners don't have something to offer, which is, can be extremely valuable, especially with a level of detachment from the artist. But yeah, there's something special about just getting it straight from the source in a way.
Yeah. Earlier, when you were talking about hearing Girl from Ipanema and The Stand Gets Sound, and I understand what you were saying, because I just hearing that in my inner ear at the moment, it's just a different sound. But I wonder, what was the sixth grade saxophone band sound? What am I supposed to take from that?
So I was playing alto, and I can remember, by default, most people have this mouthpiece that comes with the student instrument. It tends to be really closed. And so that means the sound is going to be really pinched generally and nasal and relatively difficult to tune. Whereas the sound that I heard on the recording was this sort of glorious, breathy, warm, rich sound. Dry also, but yeah, something about it. There's like a beautifully half lit by light or something with beautiful shadows. That was the thing that it felt like to me. It was, or like a cloud peering through, you know, or the sun peering from behind a cloud. It's this epic, dramatic, sublime image. That's what I heard.
It's one of those recordings that is such a rare blend of the way the musician shows up and the attribute, the elements you just described, whether it's the relationship with the instrument or the equipment itself being just right, and just wonderful engineering. It's just one of those moments that it's clearly all highly, highly competent practitioners who came together to make a record like that.
Yeah. Have you heard the story about the mouthpiece?
No, no, please.
So I read that when he went to Brazil, his like horn got stolen from the back of a car, or he left in a cab. Something happened. So he didn't have the mouthpiece that he normally used. So he had to get last minute whatever was available nearby, and he just made it work. And I think that's part of it, because listening to all his other recordings, there's a degree of comfort when like the sound is not as breathy, generally speaking, for him. But on that particular recording, he just used whatever and made it work. And that kind of blew my mind, because for me, that's a lesson of sometimes it doesn't really matter what the equipment is, or being thrown into the unfamiliar situation can lead to something even better than what you expected. So
I mean, that's not dissimilar from the Keith Jarrett story with the Colm concert, right? With the he in the broken piano and making what at the time was the best selling jazz album. That's just such an incredible. So it goes to what you were talking about in your improvisation, right? It's like there's those were artificially or universal, like those were constraints imposed by the universe, whereas you're bringing some guardrails or some parameters within which to improvise, so as to, the words escape me, but I would think of words like focus or sharpen, or because the universe is so big otherwise and so sprawling. And how do you keep the improvisational moments in the service of the vision and the composition? And so by taking away variables from the players, you sort of free them.
Just having constraints, like this is another thing I had in college, like idea of constraints when you're writing, or something that it's like it's counterintuitive, but you're way more free if you have some sort of restriction, because then you just have to do it. And yeah, again, striking the balance of how much is productive versus how much is counterproductive. And you know, it depends on genre too, but one of my New Year's resolutions is I only want to write as complexly as I need to. And basically I want to try to keep it as simple as I can as I'm writing, because that's a thing that I've been working on over the years, is try not to overwrite. And I think being in New York also helps you with that, because when you realize how good just the caliber of the musicianship and the artistry of so many musicians here, almost all the time, I feel like the musicians I'm playing with, they're improvising stuff that's way better than anything I could write. And so that's what I want to harness, really. Like, I think I'm an okay composer, but maybe what I could do better is try to just orient the knowledge and the wisdom of the musicians I'm playing with so that they sound their best, because that greatly exceeds whatever I'm putting on the page, in my opinion.
We'll be back with more Spotlight On right after this break. Bonus Tracks is the official blog of Spotlight On, available at spotlightonpodcast.com/blog. There you'll find additional artist interviews, music commentary, and more. Have a look. And now, back to Spotlight On.
It's interesting that you're thinking about composition that way, because something that struck me in listening to the Depths of Memory albums is just how thoroughly composed the music is, but it's not impenetrable or dense. It straddles this line of almost, and again, I'm not a musicologist or a theorist, so I apologize if I get it wrong, but you can hear the compositional elements and even like maybe a classical influence or modern music. Like, it's all there, but it's not inaccessible. And it's something that I really enjoyed about listening to those records.
I appreciate it.
I'm curious a little bit about like the structure or process of that project of Depths of Memory. And there's a volume of music to start at the end. What led to the release strategy, if you will? Why was it broken up? Why was it presented in sort of these volumes, if you will? How are you thinking about the presentation of it?
The release of this album, double album, is pretty different from anything I've done before. And the biggest reason is that I started working with the folks at La Reserve Music. So La Reserve is basically a record label, but they also are sort of specialists in digital distribution. They have great relationships with streaming platforms, curators for jazz at Spotify, Tidal, these sorts of places. I had pitched a separate record to them for release. At the time, we had never met or spoken. They were basically like, we like the music a lot. We're not 100% sure we can fit it in, but send us whatever else you have. I sent them the double album because it was ready to go. I was going to just self-release it. And they said, we love this. We want to put it out, but how do you feel about this strategy of basically extending the release cycle over a longer period of time? What they told me, they were saying, we can tell you put a lot of time and effort into this. From our experience, the best way to get the best results in terms of reception and visibility is to extend the release cycle. So have more singles, build up some buzz that way. If you're comfortable with that, we think that would be the ideal approach. And at that point, the music had been ready for at least like 6 months. Like, it was totally mastered and ready to go. And I had composed a lot of that music. I had started composing that music over 5 years ago. It was a really long process. And so I didn't really mind. I figured if I've already waited this long, with waiting a few more months, if it is going to do what they think it will do. And I was really pleased with the results of the campaign. And so I think both me and also La Reserve, we were both really satisfied with how it turned out.
It borrows a lot from the way pop music is marketed, you know, sort of a longer campaign, dripping singles, keeping a narrative going. Because, yeah, I think that's exactly right. If you could easily drop all of this music that you put so much into on one day, and then if the stars don't align, you've missed your window. That's really difficult.
It's really difficult. I knew going in that they had a proven track record of really helping their artists grow in their careers. So I just totally put my trust in them, and it worked out. And so, you know, we're continuing it into 2024 with future releases, which I'm excited about.
Can you tell me a little bit about memory as sort of a motif in your work?
Obviously, yeah, it's front and center in this album title, but this album and also the previous double album, The Sustain of Memory, I'm just thinking of that as times in my life in terms of what I would consider early adulthood, finishing school, moving to be on my own and work, and then thinking back on my childhood and like the town I grew up in. I feel like I just had a strong feeling of nostalgia at that time, and I wanted to try to express that creatively in some way through music. Memory is a fixation for a lot of writers and thinkers and people. and it comes and goes at different points in your life and different things can trigger it. But yeah, I think the first album was the early adulthood period. This most recent album was the really intense kind of memory experience of while dealing with the pandemic and isolation. And I think for now I'm good with wrestling with memory as a motif, but that's sort of where it falls into my work.
In the context of this project in particular, did you know you were writing for this ensemble?
This was, yeah, like my band and my project. And I knew that I did want to do a continuation of the same quintet that was featured on The Sustain of Memory. There's some personnel changes due to the availability of musicians, but largely I knew going in that I wanted Adam to play trumpet on a good portion of it. I knew the rhythm sections that I wanted, and that was going to color the sound of the music a lot.
The rhythm section is so, there are times where it's so delicate, it's really impressive, but the piano work stood out to me as well.
Dana is incredible. Yeah, Dana Saul is the pianist. I think more people should know about what he's doing.
Incredible. There was one track I made a note of, Interior Choruses.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't mind me making a commit, I heard like there's a monk element to the composition. There's a sort of an angularness to it. I could put that one on repeat. I might this weekend. I might be driving your streaming numbers on that track.
I appreciate that a lot. Please do.
I'm really taken with the fact that you have this sort of regular gig at Lowlands.
Yes.
And I can't help but think of that as a great sort of platform, knowing you have this consistent place. And I've watched some of your social media where you talk about like working out things to perform. And like, this seems like a luxury in artist development or the development as an artist.
Yeah. For me, that it's the holy grail. It's the ultimate luxury. I can't take it for granted because I feel like ever since I was a teenager, I've wanted a weekly gig somewhere where I could just work out music on my terms. And so I just feel so lucky to have this place. Yeah, Lowlands, it's just a dive bar in Gowanus. It's 2 blocks from my house. I started playing there on a monthly basis the year before the pandemic. And I learned about the bar through Walter Stinson, who's the bass player on a lot of my projects. He used to bartend there just as a gig. And through Walter, I met the owner, John Nicoli, who is a huge supporter of the arts. He creates music on his own, but he's also just a massive music enthusiast for all genres of music. He knows a lot about hip hop and electronic production and stuff like that, but he loves jazz, grew up listening to it, and he was open to it. So we did a monthly gig, pandemic happened, there wasn't anything happening. And then I was going back to Lowlands just to hang out in mid-2021, and it came up. John was sort of like, hey, how about some live music? What do you think about that? It might be fun. Bring some business back in here. And I was down and we tried it. It went from being twice a month to every week, essentially. In September 2021, he just said, just come back every week because it makes my job a lot more enjoyable in a way because there's something to look forward to. Like aside from just doing the job, there's exciting music happening and the bar can afford to put out a bit of cash. And then later on, we had more help through this organization called Keyed Up. And it's a nonprofit, supports a ton of gigs all around New York and also beyond New York and other cities. For instance, like they support a lot of the gigs at Bar Bayou, which is an amazing mm-hmm. venue in Brooklyn. And so through a mutual connection, basically, I was able to get them to help out, I think starting in 2022, and that made a big difference. And so it's been full steam ahead since then, just trying to work out music there every Tuesday.
That organization helps the artists get paid, but takes some of the burden off the venue owner?
Exactly. Yeah. It depends on the venue and what the deal is that they work out, but essentially they help to provide some amount of funding to offset the burden on the venue.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's amazing work. I'm glad that they exist.
Do you have a sense of who the audience is for those gigs? Like, do you have people that are coming to see you versus hitting their neighborhood local spot? Is there a mix?
So when I started, and it's still like this a lot, Lowlands is not in a place that attracts a lot of foot traffic. You know, it's on 3rd Avenue. It's very industrial. People love it because it's a neighborhood bar, relatively quiet, a lot of regulars. It's not pretentious at all. It's the opposite of pretentious. So when I started, especially, it was really, I was just playing for people who were just regulars for the most part, and friends and people who were just passing through. And then over the past 2.5 years or so, as we've been promoting the gigs more and more, there have been more people coming to check out the music. But I like that it's a mix because it forces you to deal with the, I don't know how to express it in a good way, but it's like the old school thing of you have to win over the audience. Like, you can't expect them to care at all for any reason what you're playing. You have to communicate it through your instrument and through the energy that you get, that you're sharing from the stage, which is not even a stage, you know, it's just you're standing on the same level as the people who are listening to you. And so you're meeting them eye to eye. You also have to read the room. And if you want to play a ballad, you kind of have to earn it because people are having conversations. But you can pace a set in such a way that when you get to that moment, everyone stops talking because they can tell it's like something special. When that works out, it's an amazing feeling. You know, you feel a real connection.
Can't help but think, hearing you describe that, the experience of doing that week in, week out is going to prove so valuable as your career unfolds and expands. And like, those lessons are what make a musician a show person. Like, what would allow to command a bigger stage or to understand how to build a rapport with an audience? That sounds phenomenal. It's like a masterclass.
I think it's the thing that it used to be way more common. And unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, economic and cultural, there just aren't that many opportunities to have to do that. And especially conservatory training, there's no replacement. Like, you can get the technical skills there, but the other part, which is just pacing a set, figuring out how to relate to the audience, intangible things. You really have to do that in person, live, and you have to fail, you know, and learn from your mistakes and try things out and see what works. In recent years, there are a ton of venues in Brooklyn that do have that nice mix of people who are not there specifically for the music, but who are maybe receptive to it. Bar Bayou is a place where the jazz is front and center, but there's still lots of just folks from the neighborhood who are just, they know it's a great cocktail bar, a nice ambiance, so they want to hang out. And you can see people, like, I've seen it going to see shows, there are people who are clearly not there for the music, but then over the course of the set, they're drawn to it because of the magnetism of the people performing. Ornithology Jazz Club in Bushwick is the same way, where there are a lot of people who might, they've just heard of it because they know it's a hit place. People like to hang out there. It's a nice vibe. But then when they actually experience the music, something changes and you can tell that they're being drawn in. So it's an amazing thing.
Are any of the places you mentioned, are they all 21 and over? Or is there a way to reach younger audience?
I guess because, you know, their bars are serving alcohol. They're mostly, 21. But yeah, that's a good question, reaching the audience that way.
This is another theme that comes up a lot in the conversations I have here, which is that it's been fascinating to watch over the last, let's call it decade or so, that jazz and instrumental music has really gotten back into the culture in a way that it wasn't for a long time. And a lot of it is through youth-oriented movements, whether it's hip hop or some of the stuff coming out of the Los Angeles scene where it's just more baked into like electronic culture. It's so exciting to see. And it's great to have young people be able to engage with it live as well.
Yeah, it's essential. We really need that, or else music is just museum music. It's funny that you say that, because I feel like this album, The Depths of Memory, is the anti, it's like the artiest expression of my music. We did play the music a few times at Lowlands, and it worked. So another thing is that I've learned is not to underestimate the audience, because you can play really experimental, sophisticated, avant-garde stuff, but as long as your heart is 1,000% in there, and it's coming out the right way, people will get sucked into it. Like Tim Byrne, who else lives in the neighborhood, he's been playing at Little Ends every Thursday. And I've seen him some of the most intense, really noisy avant-garde stuff. And people just love it. And it totally works. So yeah, that's one thing I've learned is don't underestimate the audience.
It's funny to see that phenomenon because even, especially with the horn player, you think like I've been in environments out here where I've seen what I would call like an older crowd really be responsive to like somebody just overblowing and getting their like they're channeling John Zorn or something. And like people respond, especially live when you can see the fire of the performer. Like it's much different than listening to even a recording of avant-garde music, because when you see the performer doing it, you realize like just what's going into it.
I mean, and that's one reason I feel like for me, especially, I much prefer to see like noisier avant-garde experimental improvised stuff in person whenever I can, as opposed to the recording. Cause I don't know. I think that element is just so important. There's a theatricality to it and the human drama of just like how extreme you have to push your body to be able to produce some of the sounds that are coming out. Unless you see it and you hear the sound waves like really rippling off of walls and in and out of your ears, it just doesn't have the same impact on any recording.
Yeah. I'll sort of embarrassedly admit that I went down a YouTube rabbit hole of watching various performances of John Zorn ensembles.
Oh, wow.
And amazing. Not even necessarily with him playing. I used to, you know, I was in New York for a period of time where it was a luxury. I'd just be able to see him all the time. But
yeah,
these were more performances of him conducting like various incarnations of Masada and things like that. And the physicality of the players, you know, whether it's Joey Barron playing drums with his hands or Mark Ribot just strangling the guitar. If you can sit in a room and watch that and not be excited, then you're cold.
Nothing's going to reach you then, because that's the absolute top, the pinnacle
and
of that.
And it's so fun, because it's also fun to watch the musicians be amazed at what they're doing. That always gets me when, like, at the end of a solo or at the end of an ensemble, like an interlude where they're all swinging together, and at the end of it, they're laughing. It's like, yeah, man, you did it.
Yeah.
You crossed that bridge.
Exactly. It's the joy of discovery. That's something that we live for as artists. Like, if we don't have that, I don't know. There's just, why go on? You know, it's already so hard to do it.
You mentioned Threadgill earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could talk about both as players and composers who some of your sort of leading lights are.
Of course, Henry Threadgill is incredible. In recent years, I mean, I have to give it up to Mark Turner, great saxophonist, huge, profound influence on my music and my life. He's incredible. Vijay Iyer, who's my professor in college and who I TA'd for, really heavy thinker and musician, inspiration, tons of people. Miles Okazaki is amazing. Steve Lehman. There are all these people who I feel like I've just ripped off so much of their stuff, and I continue to do it. And, you know, I'm sorry, but also it's the music's so great, I have to do it. Lately, I've been really into Ryuichi Sakamoto, who passed away last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just, something about the, I don't know, he can work with tonal music and melody, and it can be really simple and just so affecting, but also in terms of the electronic music, can be so exciting and experimental. We've been playing a lot of arrangements of his music. I've been doing that
about
the past year, which has been a lot of fun and a different sort of challenge.
I just rewatched Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence the other night. I forgot, he's so powerful. I can't believe he's an actor. It's unbelievable.
He has an amazing cameo in this, what I think is a pretty terrible Abel Ferrara movie that I saw recently. It's called New Rose Hotel. It's a crazy movie because it's like the co-stars are Christopher Walken and Willem Dafoe, but it's kind of terrible. Like it just kind of goes around in circles, and I feel like they were just doing it for fun. You can tell they're having fun, but the plot is just not happening. But anyway, Ryuichi Sakamoto is in one scene where he's a very menacing, like, corporate figure. He says almost nothing. He, like, does everything with his eyes, like the way he's looking at them, just lasers.
Yeah, he does quietly seething very well.
It's incredible. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. This is totally random, but I had COVID for the first time a few months ago. I remember the first day I was really sick. I don't know why I did this. Maybe this was like the COVID brain, but I went down a rabbit hole of trying to listen to every cover of that song. And there are like hundreds. So I was going through Spotify. It's crazy. There's so many covers. A lot of them are really boring because a lot of them are just people doing a solo piano version that's not as good as the original. But then there's some that are really interesting. Like, I think there was one, I believe it was an Argentinian pianist. I can't remember the name, but it was duo with percussion. And it was in a different meter. It was in five. And it had added sections and pedal points. And it was really dramatic. So, I don't know. It's amazing. When you hear that degree of flexibility from the source material, then you know it's a strong song.
It's funny that this is, again, another embarrassment, but I was similar, actually. I was sick. I was watching covers of John Cage's 4 minute, 33 seconds on YouTube.
Wow.
There's a funny one. There's a death metal one, a death metal band.
Yeah.
And as ridiculous as it sounds, it's incredible to watch. It's incredible.
This is like in the middle of one of their concerts or something?
No, no. It's in like their rehearsal space.
Oh.
And it's incredible. There's nothing campy about it. It's incredible.
I'm going to look it up. That sounds
amazing. Yeah, there's some great ones on YouTube. Like, there's some of them are tongue in cheek, but some of them are amazing. Like, there's a harpist that does a cover.
YouTube's an amazing place, yeah.
Oh, it's incredible.
For music.
I'm curious, is Lowlands suitable for, like, would you ever record there? Would you record a live album?
Yeah, it's funny you ask. Do you know that I'm putting out a record in 3 months that was recorded there.
Oh.
Sorry, I didn't know if you were setting me up for that, but
no,
I'm literally preparing final materials for it. yeah, so we did record in my trio, June of 2022. Mm. This is like into the first year, basically. And so that's coming out in March. And I think it came out really good. It was sort of a last minute thing. We recorded it using my laptop, 8 microphones into an interface plugged into my laptop. A really good friend of mine, Juanma Trujillo, who's a great guitarist and also a great engineer. So yeah, it sounds good. The room sounds really good. And I think we'll probably record there more in the future, but it's surprisingly good. That's one thing that we discovered, because it's all reflective surfaces. Like, it's wood floors, brick walls. You wouldn't think that it would sound good. You'd think that it would be really echoey, but somehow the layout of the room, like, it's long, and where we put the band is, it's at the very end of the bar, facing toward the front, and there's a little alcove because of where the bathroom is. So some of the sound reflects to the band, and it makes the space a little smaller. So it actually sounds really nice. And especially if you go farther away from the band, it's mixed really perfectly. Like, sometimes I go see a show and I just want to hear what's happening really clearly. I can sit at the very back of the bar and you can hear every instrument really clearly. Whereas if you sit close to the front, you get the full impact. The detail maybe is not as, it's harder to pick out the detail.
Wow, that's interesting. Was it in front of an audience or was it just?
Yeah, it's a live recording, but it was close mic'd as well. So, you know, I think it's the best of both worlds. Like, you get some audience vibe. The way we were playing was definitely like the way we normally play in front of an audience. And there were more people than normal because I just invited a lot of people because I knew that I wanted ideally to have it be fuller and it just for the vibe.
That's incredible. I can't wait to hear it. What's the configuration?
It's myself on saxophone, Walter Stinson on bass, and Matt Honor on drums. And so this is a band that I formed when I first moved to New York. We had put out 2 records. We had toured to China, East Coast, and we just had all this music that I had written over the years that I just want to get down. You know, we worked really hard at it before, and it's sort of my dream of having this working band where we don't look at any music. So all the music was memorized and we didn't have a set list. So basically I would just start playing and then they would play, and then I would like signal subtly like a song. This is another thing I took from Vijay, because he would do this. And then I would do a imperceptible to the audience kind of signal musically that we're going to go into something. And then we go into it, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, like, how did you get there? And then after the song ends, we would just keep playing and be in a vibe. And then whatever popped in felt appropriate, we could go into that. So it's an amazing feeling, because you just play the whole set. You don't say a word. You don't have to open your eyes unless you want to see the audience, but you don't have to look at any music. It's like, for me, that's like a dream musical experience.
And continuing a long line of the sort of saxophone trio, which is a great lineage.
Yeah, just trying to, I don't know, contribute in some way and trying to uphold that incredible tradition.
Do you think that that modality of what you just described, that performance style, could you do that with a larger ensemble? Like, is there something exciting about the idea of maybe a septet that you conduct that way?
Oh, man. If you have the willpower and the musicians are down, you know, and you can rehearse, anything can be done. Like famously, like Cecil Taylor's big band, he taught every part by ear to each musician. So the rehearsals were full days, 12-hour days. Then you don't need sheet music and you can just go into it and hit, and people know what's up. But
yeah,
that's a lot of work. You have to put in the hours.
I would imagine at the end of that, just because of the mental, the concentration, it's got to be tiring.
It's exhausting, but I don't know. Reading music is tiring, I think. So not having to think about that. And also, I think there's something about, I talk about this a lot with my band members. I don't know why. It has to do with memory, but I kind of like the sound of musicians remembering how a song goes. Mm. Like, because everyone remembers a little differently if you haven't played it in a while. When you get together and you're playing a song that you've played a lot, different parts come back to different people in different ways. And so it's like people are retelling a story that they know, but they're helping fill in the gaps for each other. And it comes out a little differently every time. There's something about that I find beautiful, as opposed to like, we are rehearsing this. We're telling the story word for word the same way because we're reading the music. So it's right there.
Yeah, that is beautiful. That's really beautiful. And you hit those moments where everybody remembers at the right, you know, like,
hopefully.
Okay, we're back in the swing of it, and then it hits. Yeah, that's
ideally
fun.
Yeah, that's what's supposed to happen.
Kevin, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure. Yeah, super fun conversation.
Thank you so much, Kevin Sun. As always, thank you for listening to Spotlight On, a production of 23 Media Ventures. I'm your host and executive producer, Lawrence Purrier. We're produced and edited by Michael Donaldson, with theme music by Q-Burn's Abstract Message. If you'd like to support our work, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts, and then visit us online at spotlightonpodcast.com. There you'll find our free episode archive, weekly postings on our official blog, and a ton more. Thanks for listening, be safe, and stay in touch.